Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
Good to have you with us, everybody. Yeah, welcome to the broadcast, another one where we have created what I think is going to be an outstanding broadcast. We've got later in the broadcast coming up Bill Cosgrove. We interviewed him and caught up with him in Mackinac Island. For those of you who remember, we did a broadcast while we were up there. Alex and I were speaking, and we caught up with him and got an interview in that I want to share with you. And it's pre-recorded, but it is really good. It's going to give you some insights of what the NBA is going to be focusing on as we get ready for the new year. So tune in and listen all the way through the broadcast and then tell others about it. We just got the post out there. You can go to LinkedIn and forward that around. Or hopefully, if you're not on our email list, broadcast emailing list to get notifications of upcoming broadcasts, email me at D as in David, LYKKEN at MBS-team.com. We'll make sure we get you on the list. Good to have you with us, everybody. This broadcast was created by mortgage professionals, for mortgage professionals, and we've been the proud recipient of the Progress on Lending Innovation Award for 2013. It's good to be with you all. This is one of those times where you sit and look at what's going on in the world, and leadership is such a critical thing, and I'm really excited about Bill Cosgrove's leadership for the NBA, teaming up with guys I already respect, David Stevens. By the way, happy anniversary to David Stevens. Saw a bunch of Facebook posts out there with him and Mary. Good to have. Can't wait to get him back on the broadcast, and thank you for those of you who wish me happy birthday. Turned a big 64 over the weekend. Ooh, that sounds old, but I don't feel it. Anyway, I want to say a thank you to our sponsors, United Guaranty. Last year, FHA increased their MIP insurance to 1.35%. In addition to the upfront fees, payment of 175 basis points, that means United Guaranty's MI's insurance offers more of a savings in the short and long run. Here's some things to keep in mind when you're looking at MI insurance. United Guaranty's pricing is nearly always competitive as FHA, and FHA would love to actually have a little less market share, and so they're encouraging you. Well, I don't know if they're directly encouraging. This is my interpretation. I'm sure they're encouraging people to use UGIs in the conventional markets as much as possible. Also, United Guaranty can offer faster and less complicated closings because of the company reduces the need for FHA appraisals. That's a big consideration. Also, you look at what United Guaranty offers is that more premium payment options. Boy, I must have had a good birthday. More premium payment choices, including single, monthly, and lender-paid options. Also, United Guaranty offers coverage on low-payment loans for second homes and condos. That's a bit unique. So be sure to check out all of what they have to offer at www.ugcorp.com. Also, get a hold of your local representative. Mortgage insurance underwritten by United Guaranty Insurance, Residential Insurance Company. Appreciate having them as a sponsor. Also, Velma, Virtual Electronic Marketing Assistant. Great service. If you're looking for an email assistant, a service, and a CRM tool, you got to check out Velma. Go to Velma.com, www.velma.com. Get a hold of Brent Emler. Hey, some word on upcoming conferences, September 7th through the 9th. The MBA's Risk Management and Quality Assurance Forum will be at the Intercontinental Hotel in Miami. It's really one of those conferences. I keep saying, you know, we listen, we read, we stay up to date on things, but there's nothing like attending one of these conferences. There's so many things to be keeping yourself current on. You got to get it through full immersion of 2 days in a place where that's all it's being talked about. Now, what's really interesting is some of the headliners, some of the top people in risk management, even from FHA and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, will be speaking there this year. It also offers detailed sessions hosted by each of the risk management and fraud experts. They're going to be talking about measuring, tracking, reducing loan defect rates, mitigating repurchase, indemnification, and rescission risk, a host of really important topics. And you got to get to this conference. So make sure you check out the MBA's Risk Management and Quality Assurance Conference and their forum. And it's September 7th through the 9th in Miami at the Intercontinental Hotel. Good to have you all with us. We appreciate you tuning in. Appreciate our sponsors. And so many of you are out there and tune in. And we had Chris Radek dialed in from Burke and Herbert, one of the oldest banks out there in, I think it's the oldest out there in Virginia. So, Chris, good to have you tuning in to listening. For those of you who dialed in a little early, you get to talk to us. We try to turn on the mic if it's not too frenetic around here getting ready for the broadcast, like turning on the mic. And so Chris was there early, had the privilege of talking to him. Again, thank you to so many of you listeners who tuned in. So let's get a checkup of what's going on in the markets. Joe Farr, got your website up here. Love your website, by the way. Great stuff, great information. So what's going on today?
Well, we've been a little volatile today, not big swings, but we're near the lows of the day. We're unchanged from where we ended the day on Friday. The only news to come out today was really the new home sales, which were a little disappointing, and the market improved on the news. But we've since given all that back. People could be priced anywhere between up 4 and up 2 for much of the morning, and we're now at up 1. So no concerns about negative repricing at this point. The new home sales came in at 412,000 units annualized. 425 were expected. The prior month was revised a little higher. And, you know, this is a volatile number, Dave, and the reaction's been pretty muted to it. Stocks, though, have been on a good run. They're off their highs for the day. The S&P at one point today crossed the 2,000 mark, so that was the first time ever.
Yeah, that's kind of one of those headliners. Yeah,
it is like the when the Dow hit 17.
I look at new home sales, especially when you look at new home starts. Last week that number far exceeded expectations, so we sure hope new home sales pick up and encourage the builders to keep building, because there's nothing that can impact the economy as having builders starting to put sticks up in the air. So we got to get them sold. So hopefully we'll see that number improve next month. Let's look after last week.
Yeah, after two pretty good weeks to start the month of August, last year was not a good one for mortgage rates. MBS prices fell about 10/32 on the week, and mortgage rates rose about 5 basis points. But, you know, much of that was a reversal of what happened the week before when Russia crossed the Ukraine border, and there was that report about a firing upon the Ukraine or the Russian convoy. Yeah. That all got reversed. Stronger than expected economic data last week was, weighed in on the MBS market. In the housing market, as you were talking about, home builder sentiment rose, housing starts beat expectations, existing home sales were better than expected. So, you know, this again, this new home sales number is kind of volatile, and so, you know, it's not certainly an indication of a slowing market. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I bet. It's encouraging.
The economic data that came out last week also was pretty good. You know, the Philly Fed beat expectations. Jobless claims fell below 300,000 again.
Yes.
Continuing claims were the lowest it's been since 2007. So all pretty good. Last week we had the Fed minutes to deal with.
Some hawkish tones there.
Yeah, a little more hawkish than what people had anticipated. It caused MBS prices to fall just a bit. But still no reason, no guidance to expect a sooner rise in the Fed funds rate than what had been expected, just a hawkish tone. And then Yellen's speech on Friday at Jackson Hole, boy, that was wishy-washy. I mean, it gave us both reasons to be favorable or unfavorable for mortgage rates. And as a result, not much happened.
Pick and choose out of that speech what you want.
Yeah.
It's like that was really, really a little mixed message is how I read it.
And then this week, we have durable orders tomorrow, second look at GDP on Thursday. Friday's got core PCE and personal income. It's really a pretty busy week. We also have consumer confidence, consumer sentiment. Pending home sales will be a big number, and jobless claims on Thursday, Chicago PMI on Friday, and then Treasury auctions. Always got to keep in mind what might come from headlines across the globe.
Yeah, well, with what's so much going on across the globe, that's probably one of the things. And that really underscores, Joe, with the importance of having a service like this, because the market reacts very quickly to what's going on overseas. And we can have, you know, for guys that are managing pipelines, it's just essential they have a service like this. It's just, again, the part I love the best, it's short, sweet, to the point. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Looking forward to having you on all the way through the broadcast and getting some of your comments on Bill Cosgrove's comments after we get a chance to play him. So, good. All right, folks, we'll be right back after this brief break.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS Quoteline delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur. Get MBS prices as trades happen. Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock-float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect. And know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS Quoteline, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS Quoteline today at MBSQuoteLine.com. MBSQuoteLine.com. 646-716-4972. The Lickin' on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lickin.
Was that you screeching there in the background, Paul? This is we got Paul Morrow on the line.
Oh, I didn't know the mic was open.
I just turned it on as I heard this.
I was yawning or something. I should.
There's a way to notify you I'm going to live. I need to do that. I'm over at your website, www.imfnews.com. Folks, if you're not tuned into this one, check it out. Signed up for the daily blog posts. You should get the notifications of them, and they get emailed right to you. Also, if you're looking for a place to advertise, folks, great place. What Paul writes gets a lot of eyeballs, so it's a great place to put some advertising up. Tell us what you got here, bud.
Well, I would have made the lead story Lichen turned 64, but I didn't know about it until this broadcast. That was big news for the industry, right?
No, we don't want that out anymore.
No. Right, what do we got here? Well, John Bancroft crunched the numbers for the large some of the largest players in mortgage banking for the second quarter. You know, it's not surprising, but, you know, there was a nice bounce back in profits in the second quarter. The first quarter was ugly for just about everyone. Second quarter, some nice numbers. Guys are earning money on lending again and servicing. Servicing has been pretty steady. But, you know, I've been talking to some warehouse guys the last week or so because we're doing our warehouse roundup soon. And, a lot of lenders are, you know, making money on reduced volumes. They cut their whatever fat they had to cut out of their organizations. I know in the past you've been a big proponent of lenders cutting, vigorously and quickly to make sure they're back in the black. So, you know, it looks like, you know, things have stabilized in the industry. Everyone keeps hoping for, the purchase money business coming back. Rates, as Joe has said, you know, rates have dropped in the last 2 months, and, you know, there's a little more refi activity, but, you know, it's an interesting time in the industry. We're still trying to figure out, you know, whether all these companies introducing non-QM loan menus are going to be doing any significant volumes, and that's going to be something we're going to be watching, not just what's left of this year, but all of next year, because there's been a lot of that going on, so... story number two, we got another offering from Phoenix Capital out of Denver. They're selling a big bulk portfolio for Fannie and Freddie. Not that big, but $1.1 billion. What's interesting about this, they, like most of these brokerage firms, they don't disclose who the seller is, but they do mention that it's an affiliate of a publicly traded company. And the subservicer is LoanCare. So that'll be one to watch. We also pulled the comment letters on the G-fee hikes, and it's probably no surprise, but... most of the industry does not want a guaranteed fee hike at this time. SIFMA is, a little on the fence, and the big proponents of the jumbo market, of course, you know, do want a G-fee hike because they want some of that business coming back to jumbo. So, also, the SEC is going to vote on the non-agency MBS rules, known commonly as Reg AB2. It's one of the rules that's under consideration. These are rules that govern non-agency mortgage-backed securities and others. I'm not a real expert on that space. That was written by Brandon Ivey, but that's something we'll be watching on Wednesday.
That's a good article.
Non-agency market, yeah.
I went through that. That's a good article.
Yeah, the FHA. Other big one is the Goldman settlement on Friday that happened after we
yes.
went to the press. And, you know, what's interesting about that is there's only like three more settlements left out of 18 original defendants. And the biggest one, which we blogged about on Friday's website in the What We're Hearing column, you know, people forget Greenwich Capital is owned by RBS, Royal Bank of mm-hmm. Scotland, which in turn is now owned by the British government. So they have a lot of exposure. They were one of the largest underwriters of subprime MBS during those boom years. And, you know, if B of A settled for, $13 billion or whatever with the FHFA, you know, gosh, what is the number that's going to come out of Royal Bank of Scotland, not just for the FHFA, wow. but for the Department of Justice? You know, these guys must be facing some huge exposure.
Huge, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And where's the money going to come from? It's ultimately, I would assume, it might be coming from the British government. So that's a, you know, no one in the media has really picked up on that, maybe because they keep forgetting that Greenwich is owned by RBS. But I think it's an interesting story, and what makes it more
it's
interesting
a huge
is that
story.
They did a lot of securitizations for Ameriquest and Argent, that large subprime lender which closed its doors
right.
back in, I think it was 2008. So I think that's real interesting. One of the stories in Short Takes today, we have Altasource back in the news. They're apparently expanding
hiring.
Rapidly again in India, and they're hiring 500 people in India, which rubs some people the wrong way because they want these jobs in America. But that's a show you could have a debate on, I guess. It's, you know, good or bad, outsourcing American mortgage jobs to India. That's probably a topic which I've covered from time to time over the years. So that's all the good stuff. It's all on the website, www.imfnews.com.
There is a lot of good stuff. It would be a good segment. We need to get Alice's news. She sold to Indicom, which is based out of India, and
right.
there's some great
right.
folks there. It is it's a real interesting discussion when you go to our cost structure of our industry right now. It's hard to argue that trying to defray costs through outsourcing, offshoring, doesn't have some merits. But I tell you, I'm a flag-waving guy. I want all the jobs here. So, man, that's a great suggestion, Paul. We may have to have you line that one up. We'll do that. It's good. Always good to have you
line it up, and I'll write about it.
Okay, there you go.
Because I know Indicom's in that space, obviously, and there's, you know, NationStar's got some back office overseas. Aquin is the big one.
Almost everybody.
You know, there's
some
other firms there. Go ahead.
Yeah, other people do have back offices there. So it's a reality of our industry today, even though some may not want everything with the Made in the USA label on it. More and more things are being done offshore because of the cost structure. So,
yeah, I just wonder, you know. Anyway, like you say, that's another show.
That's another
show.
We'll
get into that another time. So.
Well, be sure to check out his blog at the blog IMF News, www.imfnews.com. Great place to advertise. Great place to stay informed of what's going on. It's up to date. Paul's a part of it, so that's why we pay attention to it. There's some great folks there, though. All of the folks there are good. Thank you so much, Paul. Appreciate you being
Thank you,
a
David.
Part of the broadcast. You bet, man.
Bye-bye.
You bet. Have a good one. Let's move over to Alice Alvey. You got a quick report for us, Alice, on what's happening in the world out there as it relates to regulations. I know we're on vacation. They got the legislators on vacation. What you got? Alice. Oh, no.
Hey, I'm here. Sorry about that.
Oh.
Yep.
Uh-oh. Right, I said, oh, no. Is it me? Technology showing up again. Love it. Anyway, go. What you got?
Hey, well, I know we want to make sure we have plenty of time to cover having Bill Cosgrove's information on the show. So I am just going to keep this quick here for folks in terms of HMDA reporting. So HMDA reporting, and then of the CFPB has and the CFPB's common extension period for public data on complaints. So with these two things in mind, I want to give folks a heads up on, you know, the comment period to post your comments for the new HMDA proposed rule is open until October 22nd. It's going to take you that long, you know, to be able to go through the details to make sure you fully understand the complexity. If you remember, back about a year ago, CFPB published their HMDA resubmission guidelines. And there was, you know, this full article about the fines and penalties that they have imposed for inaccurate HMDA mm-hmm. reporting. So they last year tried to make a big case about how important this is to them. Do you know if you have so much as only one error in a sample size of 30 loans, they now move to a full review of your HMDA data? One error. Now, you have on any given one loan, you have right now today about 20 potential data fields. You have in the future with the HMDA data adding another 25 data fields. So for every loan hitting well over 40 data fields when the resubmission guidelines are this tight and when the full review guidelines are now this tight. So I think that companies really have to pay attention to this. You know, folks think, well, I'll just have to throw more data on a report. It's not going to be a big deal. Yes, it is. We do need to fight what is reasonable, what is relevant at that level for reporting. You know, certainly if we want to put in an LTV, that to me is not that big of a deal to start wanting to add loan to value. But to get into trying to put in AUS results, getting down to the borrower's credit score, DTI, lien priority. There's a bunch of fields out there that we really need to take a good hard look at to say how much of this really makes sense and can we divide this up into a couple of phases? Do we need to really make sure they address the resubmission guidelines at the same time? So there's my quick point on HMDA data. Make sure you check that component. The other piece is that until September 22nd, I believe is my date, that we have to comment on the CFPB wanting to include the narrative portion of a consumer complaint in the public record. So today, you can go to their website, pull a spreadsheet all about all the consumer complaints that have been filed. Well, they're really wanting to add the narratives that have been put out there. So can you imagine that? Your customer just free typed in, Dave, happy birthday, but I'm really upset about how my loan process is going, right?
Yeah.
Put in that as a comment. There's no edit process, right? It's the CFPB. They say they'll take out personal information, but they're not going to necessarily validate if the customer is telling the truth, if the customer is, you know, completely off the mark on what their comments are. So I think there's a very significant concern that the narrative should not be published, and I don't think it's a detriment to consumers that they're not published. So folks really need to get on the bandwagon for this to make sure that doesn't happen. We're already running around responding to audits. This is just going to make it worse, and there's going to be some public reputation risk just posted out there. So make sure you get your comments. The comment period just got extended. It did not expire last week as originally planned. You now have a chance to go back, go to the CFPB website. It's right there for you to post a comment and get that posted now. Narratives should not be published. They're not helping consumers, and it'll be a detriment for a lot of misinformation. That's my two cents today, Dave. I'm swinging it back to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Alice. I appreciate it so much. Folks, because we have a 35-minute interview that I really want to get to with Bill Cosgrove, I want to apologize to Sam Garcia and Tony Garitano. I don't have time to get to your segment. I really want to. So please, let's get back you guys back next week. I want you to check out progressandlending.com. Go to www.progressandlending.com as well as www.mortgagedaily. Outstanding information that they have. One is technology focused. The other is really just industry focused on all that's going on in the industry. Particularly what I like about Mortgage Daily is the information it has, the research information. So we're now going to play the interview that I recorded when we were in MMLA or Michigan Mortgage Lenders, a conference up in Michigan. So without further ado, here's the interview with Bill Cosgrove. Bill Cosgrove, it's such an honor to have you here with us on the radio. And for those of you in the listening audience, Bill Cosgrove is the incoming chairman of the MBA.
And Bill has got an illustrious career of 28 years in the mortgage industry. And I would be really interested, Bill, in understanding, and our listeners would be starting, you're now going to be the chairman of the entire association. How is it that you started in this business, and what's your journey through this industry?
Wow, it's, you know, David, it's a great question. I started, actually, I came from being a real estate agent. I was, I was 21, 22 years old, going to college part-time. You know, in my family, it's a blue-collar, probably lower middle-class family. Not sure what I wanted to do, was interested in sports, but didn't have the talent to play it collegiately. And I got my real estate license when I was 22 years old. And next thing I know, I'm selling houses while I'm living at home, right,
wow,
with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
As a young kid, and I was too young to realize that a 22-year-old shouldn't be selling real estate, but I was, and I did. And when I was 24 years old, the fellow who, the mortgage banker, which I didn't really even know the term then, that was doing all the mortgage business as the homes were being sold, asked me if I ever wanted to get into the mortgage business. And everything was done by hand back then,
as
we all know, right? So I had this little calculator and a ton of papers, and I thought, gosh, this doesn't seem as fun as driving people around. But I realized two or three months later, he asked me again, and that's how I got into the mortgage business. And from the first day in the business, I just fell in love.
So what is it that you loved about this industry?
You know, for me, as a 23-year-old person, looking back, starting my career as a loan officer, what was exciting to me, a great real estate agent would sell four homes a month.
Right.
Well, back then, and probably now, a great loan officer would take and close 20 applications a month. And for me, it just seemed as though the learning process was accelerated. And I realized something as a young person. The first thing I realized is I was competing against a lot of people with degrees in finance. But see, I knew the real estate transaction. I knew what a seller wanted.
Yes.
I knew what a buyer wanted. I knew how to negotiate the contract, the real estate itself. And so in that sense, to me, the financing side came easily. So I understood the inner outs and how to work the streets on the transactions. And for me, you know, I hit the ground running and never stopped since. It's been tremendous. So that's where I'm in business.
Now you own your own company. And
right.
What the name of your company is?
Union Home Mortgage Corp.
And you've owned this for how long?
15 years.
How did you start that? What was the let's go to the genesis of that, the beginning.
Well, what happened when I was a loan officer in greater Cleveland area, after about 5 or 7 years, there were about 10 of us loan officers from different companies, couple banks, couple independent mortgage bankers, and we were kind of known as the superstars of Greater Cleveland. So basically, I was one of the top loan officers in all of Greater Cleveland in my mid to late 20s. A group of other people wanted to get together, people I worked with, and said, hey, let's start our own mortgage company. And back then, not as a broker, but as an independent mortgage banker, back then you didn't need more than probably $200,000 to $300,000 of capital.
Okay.
So we were able to round that up. And, you know, we met until we got our office space done. Our meeting space was 7 a.m. at the McDonald's, literally for about 2 months.
Wow.
Right? We built that mortgage company up for 7 years, and that was the time I was 27 to about 32. I was sort of the baby of that group. There were five of us owners, and naturally, you know, two owners can't get along for, you know, more than 5 years normally. So five of you have no chance, right?
Yep.
Sort of, it's like the Beatles plus one. It's not going to work. It's never going to work, right? So what happened is I left that company after 7 great years. We were the number 2 lender in all of Greater Cleveland.
Wow.
Metropolitan Cleveland's a pretty big area, behind another bank. And at that point, I went to what is now Union Home Mortgage Corp. And bought my own company and sort of paved my own way. So from a young age, from the late 20s, for some reason I've yet to figure out, my path took me on the business side of the mortgage business in my late 20s, and I fell in love with the business side of the business as much as I did being a loan officer, and it's that's been the path ever since.
Well, you've had an amazing career, and it's so good. It's interesting that you started in originations. I did, too, right out of college, so it's a great place to start. What is your perspective of how things have changed in the home buyers over the last 10 to 15 years?
Well, I think, you know, David, I still think as an industry today, after the crisis, we're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Right? We're trying to figure out where is the first-time home buyer, because today we realize, and you'll hear this from me during my term as chairman, one of my bedrock issues is going to be the first-time home buyer, because the first-time home buyer statistically has been 40% of the marketplace.
Correct.
So, you know, I didn't graduate from Harvard, but I figured out a long time ago that if you don't have that influx of first-time home buyers, then the move-up buyers struggle. Home values struggle, right, for the move-up buyers, and sort of the whole ecosystem of real estate is out of sync, and I think today we find it out of sync. So as the first-time home buyer, you know, you talk to the Mike Frantantonis of the world at MBA and the Doug Duncans at Fannie, and, you know, we know there's wage issues, right? The median income for the young person today is depressed versus 20 years ago. Student debt is a huge issue. It's skyrocketing. So you take the combination and the millennials, their home ownership, they're pushing off. So it seems as though everything is getting pushed off about 5 or 7 years. What used to be a 25, 27-year-old young person buying their first home is turning into a 30 to 35-year-old, and the market is still trying to digest that.
There is no question that we're struggling with the millennials to get them into the market. The interview of David Stevens on Bloomberg with his daughter, Sarah, I believe it. Is it Sarah?
Right.
And that was a fascinating, because here David is championing this, and yet we hear Sarah talking about how home ownership is not right for her and she's engaged. So I see that as a challenge. And one of the things I want to talk about is the face of the home buyer today. What do you see as the face today?
Well, if you look at the statistics forward, the face of the first time home buyer is going to be a diversified market. It's going to be completely diverse. And today, it's funny. I just read something last week where the headline was how to take young people from your basement to home ownership. Right. And today, because they're living in their parents' basement. You know, when we were growing up, it was a given that you're going to, one of the passages of adulthood, of success, is home ownership. It was like breathing. It was not even a debate. And I think today, and you look at this with Sarah, and I haven't had this discussion with Sarah, but there's almost a decade of media, there's a decade of regulatory debate, there's a decade of political debate questioning the value of home ownership. Right, and I think you have a whole generation of young people in America that home ownership that we value so much and has been valued for 100 years in this country is now being questioned. And so as an industry, we have to be part of the education process and we have to be part of the answer. We also know that diversity, the future home buyer is going to be a diverse buyer.
Yes.
In every way, shape, or form. And that's what, you know, immigrants, all kind of diversity, and that's really where as an industry, and especially with the credit issues that we have, the tight credit box, so you have a diverse home ownership of the future, but yet you have a credit box as tight as it's been in 40 years.
Right.
Something's got to give.
Yep.
Something's got to give.
I want to get to that. I want to get to credit in just a minute, but with still historically low interest rates, the home inventory is becoming available, and it seems that now is a great time to purchase a home and to make that an investment. What do you think is the impact of consumers' home buying decisions?
I think it's what we're talking about. The first thing is it's job, 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 right? So are we, as a country, creating a part-time job world? Is that what we're creating, or are we creating a full-time job world? First thing is, the job numbers that come out, are we being told the truth?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right? Are we being told
That's
the
great.
Truth?
Great. I'm glad to hear you even asking the question.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of, Well, we don't know if they're part-time jobs or full-time jobs. So number one, we need to be, when the government releases data, we need to be told the truth.
Yes.
Because no one's going to buy a home on part-time work. So it needs to be full-time work. As an industry, I think we need to question that more and get more involved in that area.
Great to hear.
Yeah, we need to do that. I think that's just simply a fundamental. So it's a matter of full-time work. It's a matter of making sure the wages are right, you know, for home ownership. Some of that we can't control, and we know that. The other piece of it is the credit bucket.
I look at the size of the credit box that we are putting people in now. We look at what it was a few years ago, and we're looking at something that looks quite different from last year. Do you see the credit standards beginning to loosen, or are they going to stay as tight as they are?
You know, it's interesting. I think if you ask 10 people this question, yeah, you're going to get 10 different answers.
You are.
So I think to differentiate, the credit box is tight where it's most important, and that's where with the FHA borrower, the first-time home buyer, that credit box is as tight as ever, okay? Where the loosening seems to be is on the middle to upper end,
right,
of the box. Well, that's the part that doesn't need
loosening, yeah,
right? Because they're going to get a loan no matter what. But it seems like maybe some of the products, some of the underwriting on the non-QM space is being loosened. But your red, white, and blue, your middle market, that credit box is as tight as ever, and that's a problem.
Well, I'd like your thoughts on this. I agree with you. First of all, it is tight, and I think it's a reaction to what happened in the last housing cycle. And how do we get to a point where we loosen at the first-time home buyer at the buy where it needs to be loosened without getting back in a horrific ditch that we found ourselves?
Right. There's a balance there somewhere. I think, David, you've got a couple things in play here. First, if you look 20,000 feet in the air, you still have the issue. You pick up the Wall Street Journal every day, and Bank of America is about to write a check for $17 billion, right?
Staggering.
So the attacks, in that sense, and the penalty part of the industry doesn't stop.
Right.
So until the penalties stop, until the suing of 7 or 8 years ago ends, until FHA gets a little bit more reasonable and we understand where we're rep and warrant and the I gotcha indemnifications with FHA, and we understand the political pressure they're under to get the MMI over to 2%, but I think until that ends, as sitting here as a fellow that sees the files when underwriting and origination and risk and QC, when the United Nations are all in the middle, right? The Mortgage United Nations are all in the middle,
yeah,
and they're not agreeing, they call me in. Doesn't happen often, but at the end of the day, all these things I just mentioned are floating in your mind,
right,
and you say, you know what, if this loan's on the edge, we're not going to do the loan. You know, we could do it, and it does meet the regulations, but we're not going to do it. So until those items we just talked about, that subject matter, softens or changes, it's going to be a tight credit box.
There's some great stories and lessons we learned from the last cycle, and I think
sure,
we had an overreaction. Why are consumers not more engaged in this marketplace? Is it still a hangover from the previous cycle? Is it concern about housing values? What's your perspective on it?
To me, it still comes back to jobs. I think,
I agree with you. Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, that's the bright line of home ownership. If you have a family that is secure in their job, their wages are acceptable, and they feel good about their future with interest rates where they're at, in home values where they're at, they're going to buy a home. And
yeah,
I think at the end of the day, if they're not secure in that job or it's part-time work, they're not going to purchase a home, and I think that's where it starts.
What can we do to change that? What will you be doing as
yeah,
the president
you know,
or chairman?
Absolutely. I think it's jobs. I think it's student loan debt. Has a lot to do with it. And I think demographically, from what I've been able to learn, we're almost in that tweener stage where we're at the end of Generation X, which I'm a baby boom guy born in 62. I think the end of the baby boom is 64.
Right.
So I'm the last of the baby boom. Generation X, we know, is a smaller population
right,
of people. And then you've got this you know, then you've got this huge mass of people.
The millennials.
Yeah, and so what? So we're in, right now, the Gen X's, Gen Xers are sort of in that home buying place, but there's less of them.
Right.
Right? So I think that's part of it, where I think the demographics, you've got the baby boom now in their 60s and early 70s, so they're maybe out of home ownership or their home is paid off and they're secure. So I think you have all of these items out there. And then we talk about the politics of it all in the regulation and the tight credit box. So if you look at the 6 or 8 points out there, they're all a challenge right now to home ownership. You asked the question what we're going to do about it.
Yes.
At the end of the day, my platform that we're working on at MBA, some of the things we're talking about that we'll roll out in October, really we're going to focus on the first-time homebuyer.
Excellent.
We have to focus on the first-time homebuyer. And the other thing we've got to do, and we try to do this at MBA with the housing czar, our industry needs to be regulated. We learned that, right?
Yes.
But darn it, the regulation needs to work. Right.
Yeah.
And if you're going to legislate it, and we're being held as an industry to get it right, well, darn it, as regulators, you need to get it right.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And this overlapping of regulation, Tim Geithner talks about it in his book. Whereas he, as Treasury Secretary, when he tried to work through some of the housing crisis, he, as one of them, saw the dysfunction among regulators. Well, we need to work on that dysfunction because it's hurting the markets.
I've said for years that if we don't regulate from within, we'll be regulated from without. That's
right.
Why the CFPB exists. We
right.
failed to regulate within our own industry. We saw things going on, and we didn't speak up on some of the problems. Some of it was experimental. We'd never been. We went to places we'd never been.
Right. And I think, you know, just to finish that point, if you look at the individual regulators, the CFPB, Treasury, HUD, so forth, individually, you know, they do a pretty good job.
They do.
Have a tough job, and they do a pretty good job. But when they don't speak to each other, right?
Mm.
Some of that is on purpose.
That's the dysfunction, you're right.
That's the dysfunction. But when you layer it all on top and you're the recipient of 8 different, you know, regulators in that sense, it's dysfunctional. So individually, they do a good job. But collectively, the end result is dysfunction. And it's hurting America, it's hurting the home buyer, and it's hurting the economy.
We have Mortgage Action Alliance. We need more people involved in this thing. There's no question that it's got to be grassroots where we're all involved. But let's talk about what you're going to be doing in that regard to work with the regulators. I think it'll be very encouraging to many of our listeners who are out there in the highways of bias. Is anybody talking to these regulators?
Well, you know, it's funny. When you really get involved on a day-to-day basis with MBA, and I think our members, you know, it sounds corny, but they would be amazed at the amount of work and the amount of interfacing MBA does every day with CFPB, every day with Treasury, with HUD, with VA, with the OCC, with all of them. I mean, with the Realtor Association, other trades, the ABA, they're talking to the consumer groups all the time. So MBA is really the you know, we say it, but we live it every day, the one voice in real estate finance and the preeminent voice in real estate finance. And we're proud of that.
Well, and it's not only having a voice, but how you use that voice and how you speak to the regulators.
Right.
I think there's so much frustration, pent-up frustration. People have a tendency to go in to talk to the legislator or talk to their congressman, and they blast them with all that's wrong. And when what it starts sounding like, Bill, it's all about me.
Right.
And we can't have that. We've got to look at this from a holistic way of what this industry needs. And if we speak from that perspective, and I'm really excited about you being there. Let's talk, you have a passion for the home buyer. What do you think the home buyer of the future looks like?
I think the future home buyer, it's going to be a younger buyer because I think the millennials are going to change that. This demographic is going to come on like a freight train. And that's exciting because it really is the closest thing to the baby boom generation
right.
that we've seen, right?
Yes.
So it's almost baby boom 2. And we need that. Economically, we need that.
I agree. I think it's exciting, and the scary part is how is the industry going to handle. When you have a pent-up band where people are holding back from a natural tendency of homeowners, household formation, which has a direct impact to home ownership, and we see people holding back from that out of, is this right for me now, that kind of the discussion that David and Sarah had on television,
right,
and transparent, which I think is important. For, you don't want to buy a home until you're ready.
Right.
Because it is a commitment.
That's right.
So I think there's going to be an onslaught, and I look at an industry that is, costs are going up,
right,
and how do we deal with it when that dam breaks and they start coming on us? I mean, the cost of dealing with this, how do we handle that? Thoughts on that?
Well, the first thing is home ownership has a, for the first time in our career, a public relations problem, right, with,
yes,
millennials. So I think we need to really break the mold from the past. We need to look at, first of all, how we educate the millennials on home ownership. They really need to understand what successful home ownership is. They need to understand that done right and successfully, it doesn't take up,
yes,
all of your income, number one, right? So you need to be conservative in your home ownership, but they need to understand how equity builds slowly, that it's really the pathway to wealth. I mean, what have we read in the past where if you're a homeowner, you in America, you have a net worth of about $110,000, and if you're a renter, you have a net worth of $12,000. There's nothing wrong with renting, and in America,
no,
we need low income rental housing that,
yes,
that's good and safe. Gosh, my mother grew up in public housing.
Wow.
Absolutely. My grandmother lived in public housing her whole life, and she died in 2000 and 88 years old. And when I owned a mortgage company, 28, 29, 30 years old, I would stay the evening with my grandmother in public housing. I stayed in public housing.
Wow.
So public housing is good and safe. It's a new generation. It's a new world. Home ownership of the future, I think, is going to look different than it has ever before in America. And as lenders, we need to be in tune with our borrowers. We need to be in tune with the younger generation. We need to be in tune with the consumer groups. We need to be more consumer-centric, I believe. And it's not that we're going to they're going to come to us like it was in the old days. We're going to have to go to them. And I think MBA is really driving that force of consumer first.
Yes, so you need to talk to compliance.
Those answers are generally shorter.
So, how has the regulatory environment impacted, actual union homes business?
It's impacted everybody,
mm-hmm,
right? It's one after another. So there's stress on systems, there's stress on technology, stress on people, and you want to get it right to the consumer. So I think the last 5 years, 7 years of regulatory work that's been done is, we've never seen it really in the history of mortgage banking.
So for that smaller to mid-sized company that's growing, what do you see in the future? We know we have the big integrated disclosures right around the corner.
Right.
So what does the future look like for you guys in planning for the regulatory environment ahead of us?
Well, you need more compliance professionals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it increases your costs. You need more education in that area and a lot of time to be prepared. So the costs get spread out over all the originations you do. And you have to scale your business to be able to afford that. Because I think if you're our size doing, 1.3 to 1.7 billion in lending, or if you're doing half of our volume, I think the cost to implement's the same.
Yeah.
So,
right,
companies that are under 750 million in production, and there's great, mortgage banking entities and brokers in those volume numbers, it's very much a challenge.
So what advice do you have for them? How do they cope with that, right? I now have this big expense facing me. Is it just
right
about hiring staff? What advice
well,
do you have?
Well, it's your counterparties, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your vendors and counterparties are more important than ever before. So you're spending more time vetting out the counterparties.
Right.
You're spending hours and hours, days and weeks vetting the counterparties. So it's a strategy. How much counterparty help do you need and at what cost versus hiring your own folks, right? And so it's a balance, And there's no perfect answer. I think everybody's strategy is a little bit different.
And it depends on the size. It depends on the technology, the level of technology that they're willing to embrace. It just seems like there's a mountain of problems that they're all trying to go, somebody give me the answer. So what does MBA give as the answer?
Compliance Essentials. Mm-hmm. MBA came out with just some fantastic products.
Yes, they are great.
Yeah, thank you. But no, the whole staff is doing a fantastic job, and MBA is continuing to increase their presence in education, and they see that they need to be and will continue to be the market leader when it comes to compliance essentials.
So what do you think is the key to short and long-term success then for the mortgage industry under this new regulatory weight that we have?
Well, you have to get the regulations. You can't get it 90% right. You have to get the regulations right, because then you could scale properly, because at the end of the day, it's still a scale game, right? We have to make the right decisions. We have to have the right credit box. It's all the blocking and tackling. Mm-hmm. Your cost of origination has to be in line, but you simply, when it comes to regulatory cost, you cannot cut corners.
And I think that's the challenge everyone's having right now, is I'm going to be incurring an awful lot of cost.
Right.
We were actually talking about this with a few, even the community banks and the lenders, who are just trying to say, how do I budget for that now, right? I'm going to have this big expense implementing even the things that we have in 2015, or do I, so there's going to be a pass to the cost to the consumers.
We've already seen it, really, Alice, because the cost margins were, when the market mid last year, when it retracted a little bit, you saw margins crush.
Absolutely.
Temporarily,
yeah.
Right? But we all knew that was temporary, because the cost with the regulatory burdens going through the roof. So in a lot of ways, when we get back to a new norm, the cost to the consumer is really as high as it's ever been, right? Closing costs, we just read closing costs on average are up about $75 per loan versus last year. So the costs are going to continue to go up to the consumer, but at the end of the day, the industry has to get the regulations right. That's a new game for us. Right versus 10 years ago. Right 10 years ago used to be 90%.
Right. You could make the occasional exception, like in the example you gave
That's
earlier,
right.
When you have you're the business owner and you've got to make the call.
Right. And today, it's got to be 100% right. 98% right will get you killed.
Yeah.
When we all went to school, 98% is the smartest kid in the class. In the mortgage business today, 98% will get you killed.
That's a great analogy there.
What is the one thing that nobody is talking about but should be paying attention to in the industry?
I think it's really the cost of doing business. You know, if you take the added regulation in doing it right, because every loan's has to be perfect, right? We've got to be perfect. And if we're not perfect, we pay a major price. So the challenge is the continued cost of producing a perfect loan. And at the end of the day, with the competition in the marketplace, you know, how do you do it and do it profitably? One of the things we talked to the regulators about is over the last 10, maybe 7 to 10 years, name me one major new entrant into the marketplace.
Yes.
In the last decade. There's not been one. I don't believe there was one. In that sense, there's something wrong with that.
Do we need to change the barriers of entry for this industry?
You know, obviously the regulators, Fannie and Freddie, they want more, right? It's at $2.5 million,
right.
And they want to take it, you know, upwards of $5 million. I think there's
yes.
I think that's one area today where we have it right. I don't think they should be lower. I think that would be wrong. But I don't think they should be much higher either. I think that's where it should be.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I think if we start going too high, then there's going to be a concentration
right.
of that's not going to be healthy. If we go back to the 250,000 net worth, which was admittedly too low,
right.
we're going to find ourselves back bringing in a crop of people that don't have an appreciation for the credit standards
right.
and all the dynamics that go into it that
right.
got us all out.
I agree with you. I think in that issue, I think the market has worked.
I have so many questions. I want to wrap up one on education. You talked about borrower consumer education. Fiscal literacy in America is a real problem.
It is.
And any thoughts on what you're going to do? Be able to? Is the MBA focusing on that?
Well, the MBA is fantastic at educating its own members.
Yes,
right?
they are.
Compliance
Excellent.
Essentials. MBA in October, I don't want to give it all away, right, but they are going to, MBA is going to do a great announcement and outreach on education.
Good.
Within the industry. We understand that we need to be a leader in education. So within the industry, MBA is going to continue to up the ante and drive the game. I think when it comes to consumers, we need to get together with the other trades. We need to partner with the consumer groups.
Good.
We all know in America today, it is shocking to sit in front of a 25 or 30-year-old professional.
Yes.
That holds a good job, has a family, and when you talk about financial education, it's shocking what they don't know.
It is.
And that's not good for America. That's not good for our industry. And we need to be part of changing that. And I think it's going to take really the industry working together, not only MBA, with all the other consumer groups, with higher education. We've got to solve that, or the country's going to continue to suffer.
I think you're the right approach. The MBA is here for the mortgage industry.
Right.
Working with other trade groups is the answer. Working with other entities that are out there that are focused, the consumer
right.
groups, that's the right focus. I'm glad to hear that. Bill, one of the things that I look at is the education that's needed within this industry.
Right.
Talk about advocacy.
You know, it's interesting, David, we have, as an officer of MBA, we have a wonderful, wonderful opportunity, and we're blessed to visit all the state associations. So the people, the industry people, professionals that come to the state association conventions are highly engaged. MBA, as you know, has a record amount of industry professionals go to their conferences. We have our Storm the Capitol Day,
yes.
right? The leadership in Washington in April. But I'll tell you, at the end of the day, that's 10 to 15% of our industry's workforce,
mm.
right? There's 85% of our industry's workforce that's not engaged in advocacy. And one
that's
of,
alarming. Yeah, we got to change that.
We got to change that. And the message I leave everybody with across the country is today, just to be a great mortgage professional, to take care of your customers honorably, your business partners, your counterparty risk, the regulators, today it's not enough.
Yeah.
It's not enough. You have to be an advocate for your industry. Just being a professional today is not enough. The game is raised. It's a new game. And it starts at the top. I challenge, in every one of my state speeches, I challenge the leadership of organizations. I don't care if it's a mortgage broker, an independent mortgage banker doing $200 million or $15 billion, small community bank, large bank, no matter, MBA has all the members, right?
Correct.
So it starts at the top. Not only do we have to be tremendous professionals in this business, and today we are tremendous
yes.
professionals, we have to be advocate. We have to be advocates.
So let's define. Advocacy is a great term, but a lot of people don't have the insights. How do I be that?
Advocacy, that's a great question. Advocacy just means to engage, right? And to be involved. You want to engage with your legislators. Everybody has congressmen. Everybody has a state congressman, a senator. Everybody has...
At the state and federal level.
State and federal level,
right?
It's getting to know the regulators, and it's really being involved with MBA, with other trade associations, and it's educating them on what we do and how we do it, and being highly engaged. And so just like you create business partnerships with everything, okay, we have an obligation and a duty to have these business relationships with the politicians and the regulators and the consumer groups.
Absolutely.
And consumer groups in your
community. So advocacy goes beyond just the politicians. It's with the consumer groups. And that's a great point.
It is. And, that's one of the last things that clicked for me. For 20 years, it didn't click for me. Why in the world did I need to engage with consumer groups, right?
Correct.
Well, you need to engage with consumer groups because the number one reason why? They have a lot of influence in the state capitol, and they have a lot of influence in Washington.
They're very effective,
and I didn't realize that. Well, once you develop those relationships with them and you have a working relationship, number one, I think it makes you a better professional.
Yes.
Because you see from their eyes some of the things that we do that maybe they don't like. Well, some of it you know, they're wrong about, but guess what? Some of it they're right about.
Yes.
Right?
But we're not going to have a healthy ecosystem you were talking about earlier until we get all of us talking.
That's right.
If we all have our independent agendas, this thing is going to stay dysfunctional. But if we get together and have a discussion and understand the differences, then I think we have a chance of having a healthier industry.
You're right. And if you look at the realtors, they are tremendous advocates. But
huge group.
Huge. But it's kind of simple because if you're a realtor, you're a realtor, whether you're in California, Ohio, or Massachusetts, and it's easier. Our industry is more fragmented.
Yes.
It's true. More specialized. And in that beauty, so to speak, of our specialization, you have the challenge of advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to overcome that for future benefit.
And it's about leadership. It really comes down to leadership, not only at the position you're now coming in as a chairman, as well as at every individual layer down throughout the rest of it. And that's one of the things I'm excited about, your leadership into the new year. And just trying to say thank you for being here, spending a few minutes here at the state local conference at the Michigan Mortgage Lenders Conference here in beautiful Mackinac Island.
Well, David, thank you what you do. Your show, the communication you do, the education you do through, I know you're having the time of your life doing it.
I do.
But this is a purpose, and it's a great purpose for the industry and for the work you do. It truly is a better industry, so thank you.
Thank you.